The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know that feeling, right? You walk into a big gallery, see something, really strange, maybe a huge, shiny balloon dog, or I don't know, a pile of old boxes, and you just think, what is this? And why is this thing worth like millions? More money than I'll see in my entire life.
Oh, yeah, that feeling of confusion and just being baffled by the price tag. That's super common. And, you know, most people go in asking, is it beautiful? Or maybe, does it look like it took skill?
Right. Those seem like the obvious questions.
But Stalabras, the author we're looking at today, he argues that those are almost exactly the wrong questions to start with. In fact, a lot of the art seems designed to make you stumble over those questions.
Okay. Let's unpack that then. So our mission today isn't really about staring at the art object itself.
Not primarily, no. It's about looking through it, looking at the whole system that makes it, promotes it, gives it value.
Got it. So we're diving into Julian Stalabras' book, Contemporary Art. A very short introduction. Sounds like it's going to be insightful.
It really is. And it's not like a guide to appreciating aesthetics. Yeah. You know, it's more like a critical toolkit. Stalabras really wants to give us an anatomy lesson of the global art world.
An anatomy lesson. I like that.
Yeah. He basically says, look, if you want to understand the weird shapes and the crazy prices, you can't just look at the art. You have to dissect the surrounding structures, the money, the power dynamics, neoliberal globalization. All that stuff.
And Stalabras isn't new to this. He's a professor at the Courtauld Institute of Art, right? He's been looking critically at this world for a while.
For decades, yeah. He's known for, let's say, pulling back the curtain on how commercial the art world really is.
What makes his view stand out?
Well, he comes at it with a really critical perspective. He's quite influenced by thinkers like the Frankfurt School. They basically look at how culture gets shaped by big economic forces and ideologies.
So not just accepting that art comes from pure, isolated genius.
Exactly. He questions how something comes to be seen as valuable or important. It's less about individual inspiration and more about the systems that elevate certain things.
Wasn't he the one who wrote High Art Light, that book about the UK art scene in the 90s, the whole YBA thing?
That's him. He was documenting the commercialization, the merging of art with branding. Right from the start.
So he's been tracking this connection between big money, branding, and art for a long time.
Precisely. His analysis is always systemic. He's less interested in, say, whether an artist has great technical skill, and much more interested in how the market decides who becomes a successful artist and what that tells us about our society right now.
Okay, let's get into the core idea then. Stalabras' central argument.
Right. So he argues pretty forcefully that you absolutely have to look at contemporary art as something deeply, like fundamentally tangled up with late stage capitalism.
It's not separate from the economy.
Not at all. He sees it as both a reflection of the global economic system and an active participant in it.
So how does it function within that system, according to him?
Primarily, he views it as a luxury commodity. And importantly, as a speculative asset. You know, something people invest in hoping its value will go up.
Oh, okay.
So the weird concepts, the huge scale, the shocking prices, he sees these as symptoms. Symptoms of a system that really prioritizes marketability and brand recognition, often way above traditional ideas of beauty or skill.
So the weirdness sometimes serves the market.
Yeah, because the economic context kind of demands spectacle. It demands something unique that can be branded and differentiated financially.
Which brings us to the whole financialization of art. That seems huge. It's not some small niche thing for connoisseurs anymore, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. It's transformed completely. It's a massive global multi-billion dollar asset class now.
And who are the big players in this?
Well, he points to key institutions that operate like, frankly, corporate giants. You've got the mega galleries, think Gagosian, Pace, Hauser and Wirth. They don't just sell art. They manage artists like brand assets on a global scale. They function like multinational corporations.
Managing the brand. Mm-hmm. Right. And then the auction houses, Sotheby's, Christie's.
Yeah, they're crucial too. They generate the big headlines, don't they? They turn art sales into news about asset performance, which of course attracts a whole new wave of investors.
Investors who might care more about the return than the art history.
That's often the case, yeah. And Stalabras argues this shapes the kind of art that tends to succeed in this market.
What does it favor them?
Well, it tends to favor work that's spectacular, visually arresting, stuff that's easily commodifiable, you know, easily shipped around the world. and definitely work associated with a clear, recognizable artist brand.
And what does it discourage?
Things that are maybe more subtle or deeply tied to a specific local context or genuinely challenging in a way that doesn't easily fit into a global investment portfolio. That stuff has a harder time.
Okay, that leads us straight into globalization. The international art circuit, biennials, art fairs, like Art Basel, that's everywhere now.
It is. And you'd think, okay, great, this means more multiculturalism, more voices from around the world.
But Stalabras sees a tension there, right?
A really significant one, yeah. He raises the uncomfortable question of whether this globalization is actually a kind of, well, neocolonialism in disguise.
How so?
Because even though it looks multicultural, he suggests it often forces artists from outside the West to adapt their work. The market is still largely dominated by Western tastes and collectors.
So non-Western artists might have to change their practice to be palatable.
Either palatable and sort of homogenized, so it fits easily into that international style, or sometimes it gets exoticized, made to seem authentically different in a way the market finds appealing.
So it's less about genuine diversity and more about adapting diverse voices for the dominant market.
That's the critique, yeah. And the result, he argues, is often this kind of smoothed out international style. You see a lot of large-scale installations, video art, things that travel well, can be shown anywhere.
But maybe lose their specific meaning along the way.
That's the danger. Stalabras puts it quite powerfully. The art becomes simultaneously everywhere and nowhere. It sheds its local roots for global market utility.
And this need for global utility, for easy recognition, that connects to the whole high culture versus low culture thing, doesn't it? The line seems so blurry now.
Definitely. I mean, pop art started it, but artists like Jeff Koons really push it to the extreme. You know, his giant, super polished sculptures of kitschy objects or consumer goods.
Right, the balloon animals again.
Exactly. Koons is kind of the ultimate example of taking kitsch or everyday stuff and elevating it to high art status. But Stalabras forces us to ask, what's the intent here?
Is it trying to be democratic? Saying art is everywhere, even in cheap stuff.
That's one reading. The more positive one, perhaps.
But you sense Stalabras is skeptical.
He leans much more towards seeing it as a cynical move, a kind of appropriation.
Appropriation? How?
Well, the argument is that the art borrows the energy, the familiarity, the instant recognizability of popular culture, like that balloon animal aesthetic, to make itself seem relevant and accessible.
Okay.
But, and this is the crucial part, the context completely undermines that accessibility. It's shown in exclusive galleries, bought by billionaires, put in museums with high ticket prices.
So it looks popular, but it remains totally elite in its function and ownership.
Precisely. It uses the visual language of the mainstream, but reinforces the economic and social exclusivity of the art world. It borrows the look, keeps it the elite context.
Which loops back to my first point, that feeling of seeing something huge and baffling in a gallery. In this crazy media world we live in, art has to shout to be heard, right? The art of the spectacle.
Absolutely. Stalabras talks about how art increasingly has to compete for attention. It needs to be massive or shocking or just incredibly visually dominant.
He uses Andreas Gursky as an example, the photographer.
Yeah, Gursky's a perfect case study for him.
Yeah.
These enormous, often digitally manipulated photographs, but not usually of people. They're images of vast systems.
Like stock exchanges. Factories.
Exactly. Huge Amazon warehouses, stock trading floors, massive apartment blocks, globalized consumer landscapes. The sheer scale of the photos is obviously competing with the historical ambition of painting.
But it's also mirroring something else.
It's mirroring the immense, almost terrifying scale of the global capitalist systems that Stalabras is critiquing. The spectacle of the art matches the spectacle and the scale of the system itself.
Okay, wow. But here's where it gets really tangled, isn't it? The paradox of political critique in art. Stalabras dedicates a whole chapter to this, and it sounds tricky.
It's probably the naughtiest part of the book, yeah. And maybe the most challenging. Because you have so much contemporary art that explicitly critiques power, critiques inequality, war, capitalism.
Right. Artists are often seen as critical voices.
But here's the contradiction. Who is buying this art? Who's funding the institutions that show it? Often, it's the very elites, the corporations, the financial institutions that benefit most from the systems being criticized.
So the critique gets neutralized because it's owned by the target.
That's the core of the problem he identifies. Stalabras calls it institutionalized critique. the radical message gets contained the moment it enters the gallery or the collection.
But couldn't you argue it's a good thing that the elites are engaging with these critical ideas, even buying the art? Maybe it signals some awareness, some conscience.
That's the charitable interpretation, perhaps, the defense you sometimes hear. But Stalabrass's analysis is quite a bit more damning. He argues it turns political critique into a little more than a fashionable aesthetic style. It's like, right. Imagine a protest sign, but it's meticulously crafted from expensive materials, maybe gold leaf, and it hangs in a billionaire's penthouse.
Okay, I see. The message is there, but the context totally changes its meaning or cancels it out.
Right. The critique is acknowledged intellectually, maybe even celebrated, but the fact that it's now a high-value commodity, an asset owned by the powerful, that sends the opposite message. It signals that even dissent can be safely consumed, owned, and displayed without threatening the status quo.
Dude, dissent itself becomes a luxury good, a commodity. Wow, the system is so effective it just absorbs its own criticism and sells it back.
That's the argument. It's incredibly efficient at doing that.
And that must fundamentally change what it means to be a successful artist today, then. It's not just about being alone in a studio creating masterpieces.
Not at all. He really works to demystify that romantic myth of the solitary genius. According to Stalabrass, the truly successful contemporary artist today often functions much more like an entrepreneur.
An entrepreneur?
Yeah. They need to be a skilled networker, a brand manager. Often they're overseeing a large studio with many assistants, almost like a CEO. Their success hinges as much on managing their brand, their signature style, their public persona, maybe even their perceived political stance, as it does on the actual hands-on creation of the art object.
So the name, the brand recognition, that's what drives the value, often more than the specific piece.
In many cases, yes. Following his logic, the price tag often reflects the strength of the artist's brand, their gallery connections, their market momentum, rather than some objective measure of aesthetic quality or skill.
Okay. So putting this all together, what does this mean for us, for you listening? How can we use this framework next time we're in a museum or gallery feeling confused by that expensive object?
Well, he essentially gives you a new set of questions. He wants you to shift your focus. So instead of asking first, is it beautiful? Or do I like it? Or is it skillful?
Start asking different questions.
Exactly. Start asking systemic questions.
Yeah.
Ask, who paid for this? Who commissioned it? Is there corporate sponsorship involved here? Why this artist, this work, in this institution right now? And crucially, what does the enormous price of this object tell me about wealth distribution, about societal values today?
That totally changes the experience, doesn't it? It shifts it from feeling passively judged by the art, like you're supposed to get it and you don't.
Right, like it's a test you're failing.
Yeah, and it turns it into an active analysis. You're not just looking at the art, you're using the art and its context as like an x-ray into the society that produced it.
Precisely. It becomes a tool for critical thinking, not just aesthetic appreciation.
And presumably, this way of looking isn't just confined to art galleries.
Oh, absolutely not. This lens, this framework of understanding cultural economics, is incredibly portable. You could apply it everywhere. Think about blockbuster movies, pop music, music festivals, even the publishing industry. You start noticing the same patterns, right? How market logic, the need for branding, the pressure for spectacle, the influence of corporate funding or global distribution networks, how all that shapes the cultural products we consume across the board.
Interesting. For me, thinking about this, the really surprising thing, the takeaway that sticks, is just how incredibly effective the art world seems to be at absorbing dissent. The idea that the critique of the system becomes one of the system's most celebrated and valuable products, that's quite staggering, isn't it? That level of co-option.
It is quite sobering. But ultimately, I think Stalabrass's analysis is empowering. It helps us see the art world maybe less as this mysterious realm of pure genius and more as a mirror. A mirror that reflects and often magnifies the contradictions, the inequalities, the weirdness of our current global society.
So it pushes us beyond just liking or disliking.
Definitely. It demands we look deeper. And, you know, if his analysis is right, if the current highly financialized art world struggles to tolerate genuine, challenging opposition because it's so good at commodifying critique, well, that leaves us, the informed public, with a pretty provocative question, doesn't it?
Which is,
if we want cultural expression that truly challenges the status quo, rather than just decorating it or being absorbed by it, what practical steps can we actually take to support or demand something different, something less compromised? That's something to think about long after you leave the gallery.
A powerful thought to end on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.